Good morning. It is truly a delight to be here. Again, my name is Corey Bruner, and I am the senior VP for a company called Vangro. Before I jump into all things SSP, I just want to take a minute and celebrate all of your work. Holy cow. Vangro is in and around four commissions for the blind, and you are incredibly active, and it is pretty impressive to see all of the work that you are doing. Just over the last couple of months, I don't know how people keep up with you all. Okay, so I'm going to talk just a little bit before we jump into SSP stuff about who I am and who Vangro is, just to set the stage a little bit so you understand better how we came to be in Omaha. So Vangro is what is called a service-disabled, veteran-owned small business. And that designation is important for lots of reasons. But essentially, the two gentlemen that own the business went to fight in Afghanistan and Iraq and got disabled. And so they are disabled veterans. And they got disabled while they were fighting, so they're called service-disabled veterans. So when they returned, when they healed and returned, they started a company called Vangro. It's called Vangro because the owners are Chris Crosby, the CRO, and Jason Vandefort Evans, the VAN. So Vangro is how it came to be named. It's been a company that's been around since 2004, so we have a pretty good history of being a small business. And initially, the company started off doing staffing for the federal government. Essentially intel analysts for the Department of Defense. Nothing related to deaf people or deafblind people. In 2018, the federal government made a decision that they were going to highlight service-disabled, veteran-owned small businesses. The acronym is SDVOSB for short. So just as you have minority-owned, or black-owned, or women-owned, or 8A, you have this designation, SDVOSB. And then a whole bunch of sign language interpreting contracts came out to the federal government that were under this designation. So these two gentlemen, who are smart, but also don't know anything about sign language interpreting, found me. And so I have been a sign language interpreter for over 20 years by way of Boston. I've been a support service provider working with deafblind folks for 22 years. And so when these gentlemen found me, I was a good resource to them to help them understand the needs of the deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing communities. And we started providing sign language interpreting services for the federal government and then expanded to community and state agencies. In 2021, one of my program managers, her name's Taylor, she set a meeting with me because the Missouri Commission for the Blind had an SSP program. And that program, the current vendor, had decided they could no longer manage the program. And Taylor has a deafblind sister in North Carolina. And so this was really important to her, that deafblind folks got services. And so we met with the Missouri Commission for the Blind, and we took over their SSP program. And I'll talk in much greater detail about what an SSP is and what a program looks like. So we started providing services to the state of Missouri for deafblind folks in 2021. And since that time, we have expanded our deafblind services to include the state of Vermont and the state of New Mexico and now this Omaha pilot. So, that brings us to why we are here. I'll talk a little bit about an SSP, and then I'll get into how the actual pilot program started in Omaha, what it currently looks like, and then what it means. So an SSP is an acronym, and I apologize if you all know this, for Support Service Provider. You will also see Co-Navigator as another name for people doing similar tasks. And what an SSP is a person who is trained to provide sighted guiding, as well as visual, environmental, and what we call emotional information to folks who are deaf and blind. And they do that in a myriad of ways. there's an assumption that most people who fit this category are people who were born deaf and use American Sign Language and then have lost their vision later in life, and that is not the case. We have, in all of our SSP programs, about 75% of the folks who work with SSPs are English speakers who are deaf and blind, and about 25% are American Sign Language users who are deaf and blind. So just a little point of note there for you. So an SSP does, you know, anything that a deafblind person wants to do, an SSP can do with them. We have SSPs that bring people, guide them to the gym, they go grocery shopping, they get to go to their medical appointments, they go to grief groups, they go to swimming lessons. Anything that a deafblind person would want to do, this SSP will take them. One of our contracts allows for a scholarship, so a deafblind person could go on a hiking trip if they wanted to, and the SSP will go with them. And guide them if needed, but give them visual and environmental and emotional description, which is really great. I'm an SSP, like I said, I've been an SSP for like a million years. One of the key elements of being an SSP is this code of conduct that an SSP adheres to. So instead of asking your neighbor to bring you to the grocery store where the neighbor's going to, you know, grab the list of groceries and they're going to put a bunch of stuff in the basket and then they're going to check out, an SSP does not do that. So when I go into a grocery store with a deafblind person that I'm working with, I will visually describe the entire grocery store. We will go up to the bananas and I will describe in pretty great detail what the bananas look like. Are they all green? Are they in bunches? Are they singular? Are they brown and disgusting? Are they, you know, ripe and perfect? And then the deafblind person picks the banana of their choice. And even if they pick the gross and nasty, disgusting brown banana, I say nothing and we go about our way. So the SSP also, so they do the visual description of the banana, but they also do the environmental description. So they may say, where I live in Vermont, the grocery store that I bring this person to is right near Ski Mountain. And there are times when we walk in and it is very quiet. There's not a lot of people in the room. But then there's 16 buses of high school kids that just came off the mountain and they're headed back to Boston or New Hampshire. And then it's pandemonium at the grocery store and they're running around in their ski boots. So I will inform the deafblind person, like, hey, what was once a quiet and nice adventure for us is now chaos. And there's 18-year-olds and 15-year-olds running around like crazy folks. One of the most profound examples for me of working as an SSP was for a deafblind professional in state government in Boston. And this person held a position that was fairly high in state government, was really beloved by his staff, and had an incredible sense of humor. And we walked into a meeting one time, and if he did not have his SSP with him, he would have no way to know that his staff was crying, that somebody in his office had passed away suddenly the night before. And he came in ready to tell a joke. And so the SSP was able to visually describe the room for him, but then also let him know, emotionally, everybody is quiet. There's two people in the left corner crying. There's this feeling of sadness so that he could go in with the appropriate tone to his meeting. So that is really the role and scope of an SSP and what an SSP can and do in and around this community. VACRO, takes this work incredibly seriously. And one of the things that we do is annually, we do a survey. We survey the deafblind folks and we survey all of the SSPs because we always want to be doing better in this work. And so I pulled a couple of quotes from feedback that deafblind folks have given us in this program. And so there's a, like, are we training people appropriately? Where are there gaps in training? Are you getting what you're needing? The biggest feedback we always get is that everybody wants more hours. There's always limited hours, which is really awful, but it is what it is. So I'm going to read you just a handful of quotes that deafblind folks said about the program. The first quote says, "The SSP program has been a godsend, expanded my world to more possibilities and a sense of empowerment. Going to the gym was something I never felt comfortable doing until I tried going with an SSP. Now I do not worry about tripping, running into other people or objects. I actually have a decent workout. Exploring different trails, parks, and walking at a brisk pace with an SSP is a game changer for me. Being in touch with my body and becoming more active on a physical level helps me improve my mental health and, more importantly, grows me spiritually, giving me a sense of purpose. Another person said, the SSP program has enabled me to independently participate in everyday activities and be an active member of my community. Without the help of SSPs, I would be unable to independently go to doctor's visits, shop for groceries, or complete continuing education certificates. Another person says, with the SSP, I feel like I have regained a lot of my independence that is lost with my dual sensory losses. Family, we don't want to trouble them all the time, and this is the same with friends. I feel like I'm using my friends and family to do things I want to or need to participate in. This is a comment that we often hear from deafblind people, that they just stop doing the things that they enjoy doing because they are sick of asking their friends or their neighbors or their spouses. Another quote says, more freedom to get out and do what I need and want eases the burden on my spouse. I have just a couple more. I cannot sing the praises of the SSP program more than I already do. This program has allowed me to have my independence back. No more begging neighbors, friends, or family to give me a ride somewhere and there just to be out of their mercy. Now I can make my own decisions and where I want to go and how I want to do things in the world again. Simply no words. I cannot explain how freeing it is to make my own choices again and have a reliable assistant to support me. SSPs rock. Amen. And then this one says, for the first time in 15 years, I bought my wife an anniversary gift without her having to come with me. The SSP guided me to the store and visually described every piece of jewelry. When I got back in the car with my SSP, I cried. So, this is a profound program on the lives of people in Omaha, Nebraska, and in the other contracts that we serve. It changes the life of people to be able to do things that they want to do and go places that they want to go without feeling like a burden on their neighbor and their friends and their kids. There are lots of statistics that family members have to take time off of work, that they have to take vacation time, that they have to miss appointments because they're helping out their deafblind aunt or uncle. The mental health statistics about how folks, I mean everybody, anybody who's isolated in their home without access to being out and in around other peers, it's a big deal, right? So, there are 42 other states that have SSP programs. 42. Actually, it's probably, I think, 38, because some of the bigger states like California and New York have several SSP programs. Helen Keller put out a great document that lists all of the SSP programs, including your pilot, with the average number of deafblind folks attending, average number of SSPs, kind of scope of practice, typical rate of pay, and then what the program does and does not allow, including hour limitations. So, once we started the Missouri program, we were informed that you all in Nebraska had an interagency council that had been meeting for years on how to create an SSP pilot for Nebraska. So I joined that interagency council pretty much after they had done 99% of the work, in full disclosure, and we were able to secure this pilot program, which we have run now for 2 years. To run an SSP program requires recruitment of SSPs, so the folks that are going to be doing that sighted guiding and that visual description, and then very effective and solid training for them so that they understand not only how to guide and visually describe, but the role and scope of their practice and the code of ethics. It also requires pretty considerable outreach to the deafblind community. Some places like Missouri and New Mexico have lots of events for deafblind folks. In Vermont, there's none, so we have to be almost recruiting one by one by one. And in Nebraska, my sense is that there's a little bit of a mix. You're pretty active as as folks who are blind, and there's lots of blind organizations, but there's not really a deaf-blind organization that we can tap into. So we will lean on and leverage key stakeholders to find deaf-blind folks and recruit them into the program. And then we do extensive training with the deaf-blind people to make sure they understand how to make requests, what an SSP does, what their role and scope is, because we don't want that systematic barrier of, now I've been trained into the program, how do I actually get an SSP to ever be an issue. So we will also do tabling events, and we've done a couple of those. And then we just, like I said, want to make sure that our systems are streamlined, easy for the SSPs, easy for the deaf-blind folks to be able to access those systems. And then we need to have a really great way to address feedback and address concerns. We are very malleable and pivot on the fly when we need to make changes in these programs. So, your Omaha pilot has a limit of 15 deaf-blind people. That's the max number that we can have in the program. We have 15 deaf-blind people and a wait list of 2. We have 20 active SSPs that have been trained. We've had 2 pretty large trainings in Omaha to train the deafblind SSPs. That's a 2-day training. One day is content-based, and then the other day is practice on visual description and guiding. We've hosted a couple of tabling events. One was the Silver Summit, and then the NFBN conference. That was in Scotts Bluff. We were not there. Vancouver was not there, but we had folks who represented us very, very well. So, what we need to do now, because this program is amazing and awesome, is make it statewide. Our program in Missouri has 80 deafblind people. Our program in New Mexico has 79, with a list of probably 5 that need to be trained. So this is this could be a huge program in Nebraska, and could make such an amazing impact on folks in this state. It is the next step for us. So just a couple of things to note about what a statewide program could look like. Obviously, the size of a program depends on funding. A pilot program is not going to be able to go statewide, so the next step is really legislative action. In many of the states, it is in state law that there is an SSP program, and then the legislature funds that program. This is a way to protect the program and ensure that it has longevity. I can't imagine the worst thing being a deafblind person and having access and then no access because a pilot runs out or funding isn't available. So having it legislated will really be the next step for us all. And then the things to consider when you're talking about creating and designing potential legislation for the state of Nebraska, is just thinking about all of the stuff that happens behind the scenes. So what a deafblind person sees is that they make a request, and then they get a call that an SSP has been confirmed. That's it for them. In an SSP's world, they are at their computer and a request pops up, they hit the yes button, they get confirmed for the assignment, they meet the deafblind person, they do the work, they close it out, they get paid. But many of these programs miss all of those back-end processes, the payroll, the scheduling software, the employee-related expenses, the tabling expenses, the interpreting services that need to be provided sometimes for folks. So when you're thinking about what a program might look like, making sure that those things are requisitely included in a program will give you lots of competition when it goes out to bid. It's also going to be important to leverage partners and key stakeholders when there's time for legislative action. I would be absolutely your go-to person when that happens so that I can encourage the masses to get to the state house and speak to why this program is very, very important. And then my other recommendation would be to find a legislative champion. This is kind of legislative action 101, right? This is how stuff gets passed in the legislature. You have to find a senator or a legislator who is interested and willing to write a bill to be able to submit it to the government to get it passed. All right, so I have just talked extensively for an incredibly long period of time. What questions do you have for me?
I have a question. This is Miguel. So is there like a checklist or a balance of when you describe visually a room?
Yeah. So the way we train people to do visual description is first to ask the deafblind person what they want, right? They're really the masters of their fate. There are some deafblind people that I bring into the grocery store, and they don't want to know where the produce is, and they don't want to know where the meat department is. They just want to know where the bananas are. So I will guide them to the bananas. But in general, the rule of thumb is start big and go small. So you start with a general sense of what the room looks like, identifying big objects, number of people, maybe not even necessarily where they are sitting, and then you get more and more detailed. And then the deafblind person will, they may come in with a question like, I would like to know where Erin is sitting, because she's somebody I'm going to be wanting to talk to later on today. So when we walk into the room, I will visually describe the room in great detail, but starting pretty large, kind of big things in and around the space, and then I will also identify where Erin is sitting in the room so that the deafblind person knows where to go. And then also the sense of the room. When I come into this room, are you all looking excited? Are you, everybody's talking or nobody's saying anything? Is there some, if I've done my homework, some big legislative action that is weighing heavily on this council that is to be discussed? Or is this meeting going to be contentious and there's public speaking, the public speaking section is full of people and everybody looks pretty angry because they're really mad at Carlos for doing something he should not have done. So that is how we typically visually describe. And that's why that second. If you'd like, Carlos, I will tell people you're not in the room even if you are. But that's why we have that two-day training. The second day is all practice, and we bring in deafblind folks to practice with the SSPs. And we take them out. They go out to lunch. They go to a mall. They, like, have to cross a street. It's like a whole thing for them. It's pretty fun.
Thank you.
Sure.
I have a question.
Yes.
This is Cheryl. How do you pick what people you're going to serve? Like, I know you mentioned you had 15 people in the program because that's all it could hold, and you have 15 people waiting, but how do you decide who gets the service?
Yeah, I'm super glad you asked that question. So for most pilot programs, it's first come, first serve. And so the first 15 people that signed up are the people who got services. We revisit that list pretty regularly. Because if there's, some folks will use this program weekly. And then some folks will use this program once a quarter. And so that disparity gives us the flexibility to maybe add a 16th person. So we are a data-driven organization, and I'm always looking at the numbers to see how can we get one more person, how can we get one more person. And just also to your note, how do we get deafblind people into the program? I should also say that we really honor deafblind preference when it comes to their SSPs. So our system allows for us to put in a preferred list. So if Erin is deafblind and she really likes Corey, the SSP, and she really would like Corey to be her primary SSP, we will always ask Corey first. And to that same effect, maybe Nancy's a really lousy SSP and nobody really wants to work with her except for this one person. But Erin's like, Nancy's on my no list. We can exclude Nancy. Sorry, Nancy. We can exclude Nancy from Erin's list. So when jobs are offered out, Nancy won't even know about them.
Does the person have to have a certain like level of deafness or level of blindness to qualify for the program?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that question too. So we went around and around and around on this. There are some programs like Missouri that have to meet a standard vision and hearing loss. This program does not. So the way we define it is if you have a significant barrier, if you have a hearing and vision loss that is a significant barrier for you to do everyday things, then you would qualify for the program. When this becomes state legislated, and I'm saying when very intentionally, there may be that there is a minimum vision loss and a minimum hearing loss that folks have to meet. And so that would mean that we get requisite documentation. The other piece is that they need to be hooked up with the Commission for the Blind. And so they're meeting that criteria as well. So that is kind of our safeguard to make sure that that folks are really in the program and should be in the program.
Thank you.
Sure.
Hi, my name is Patty. I moved from Missouri about a year and a half ago. And I have friends who have enjoyed this program for several years and always talk really well of it. And in Missouri, we do not have a commission for the blind. It's called Rehabilitation Services for the Blind.
Yes, yes.
And I just wanted the people here to realize that in case they were wanting to speak in regards to the program in Missouri.
Yes, I actually appreciate you saying that because many of the programs are either held under the Commissions for the Blind or the Commissions for the Deaf.
Mm-hmm.
This program is under the Commission for the Blind. Our program in Vermont is under the Commission for the Blind. But the programs in Missouri and New Mexico are under the Commissions for the Deaf. So that's typically where they end up being housed. But I appreciate you saying that.
Right, because it's so confusing.
It is so confusing.
Yes.
So truly profoundly confusing, yes.
Yes. Well, the School for the Deaf in Missouri is in Fulton.
Yes.
And the School for the Blind is in St. Louis. And so oftentimes people will get those reversed as well.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. Very, very true. And in Missouri there is a group called SASE, and that is the Deaf-Blind.
Primary.
Yes.
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 And it is an incredibly active group of
folks.
Yes. You know, my hope is that as we grow the SSP program in Nebraska, we can coalesce some of the deaf-blind community members. One of the things that Bangro hosts are coffee chats for all of our programs, for deaf-blind folks and for SSPs, and that's done remotely. And we often get deaf-blind folks from, you know, kind of across the country joining these coffee chats, and it's a really great way for folks to get connected with each other.
Beautiful.
Yeah,
thank
great.
You.
Yeah, of course.
I have one more question.
Yes.
I know you had mentioned that you provide, you know, guiding services and then descriptions of all the visual descriptions of like the room and people and things. What if you have a person, say, who is a skilled cane travel user or guide dog user and would not need the guiding part of your service but would appreciate the part where you would describe for them, you know, who's in the room and all the features of the room and all the visual cues that they would like to have. Are you able to, say, dispense with the guiding and go ahead with the description
yes.
type service?
Yes. And so our training model is that the deaf-blind person leads, right? So to your point, nothing about us without us, right?
Uh-huh.
So you all tell us what you want us to do. One of the great things about this program is that we are allowed to transport. So if you are a deaf-blind person who is an adept cane user or has a guide dog and you don't need me to be guiding you around, I just meet you, we hop in the car, we go to the grocery store, I tell you where the bananas are if you don't already know, and then I visually describe the bananas, you throw them in the cart, we walk over to the cashier. It just makes my job a little bit easier.
Okay.
This is also in the description of services. So when the job offer goes out, it will say, no guiding necessary,
mm-hmm.
visual description only.
Okay.
And so somebody who might feel new to guiding or the, like they, it's like a new experience for them, they may elect to be like, ooh, that's going to be a good fit for me because I'm a little nervous about guiding folks, but I love to visually describe.
Mm-hmm.
So we really do what works for you. There's a deaf-blind guy that I work with in Vermont who has Usher syndrome. And in the morning, he does not need to be guided, and in the evening, he does.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just do what makes sense in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes for him, depending on lighting, he may elect to be guided if we are going to a conference or something and there's a lot of people around. He might be like, I'd rather just be guided through this, you know, conference center. But then when he's in the the presentation realm. He doesn't need to be guided. So he just tells me what he needs, and I just follow suit.
Okay. All right.
This is Brian. What I have is not so much of a question as more of an observation, a parallel, so to speak. What I've noticed from what you've described, aside from the guiding when necessary, it's a lot like when blind people in general hire a reader, where we have someone who will like read documents for us and so on and so forth. It's, as you said, it's, you know, that's what the person needs. You know, if they need them to read faster, then they'll read faster. If they need them to just give them the headlines, they'll just give them the headlines. And so it seems like a fairly common parallel is just that the reader goes with them, so to speak.
Yeah, there is a lot of similarity in that respect, 100%. I think kind of the, maybe the bigger, I don't want to say difference, but kind of addition is that because these people are deaf and blind, sometimes there's other assistive technology that needs to be used to be able to communicate that information to them. So utilizing an environmental description method called haptics. I don't know if you're all familiar with haptics. I see no. Okay, so haptics is a way that a deafblind person can receive environmental information, typically on their back. And so we provide a haptics training for folks. So if a deafblind person came into this room and I was not able to verbally, visually describe the room, I would get behind them and I would draw out on their back what this room looked like. I would be able to point out all of the people in the room on their back. I would also be able to let them know when somebody was raising their hand and what they were saying on their back. If you were all laughing, if people were crying, if somebody came in or left, all of that happens through this tactile description system. So we provide that haptics training for folks who are deaf and blind and cannot access information either through sign language or through verbal description. So I would say like a reader on steroids is how you could describe an SSP. That's
all right. Any other questions from the board?
Just a quick one. That haptic thing, is that about the same speed of being verbal to a person, or is
yeah.
it a little slower?
Well, it, I mean, I think it depends on how complicated the space is and what's going on. So a space like this could be negotiated in real time.
Okay.
If it's a big conference that somebody's coming to, that's going to take a little bit longer and probably also require additional description, either through spoken English or through American Sign Language tactility, just because of the kind of the complexity of the space. But this room would be pretty easy to navigate through haptics.
Right. Okay. Is that a skill that the person would need to get to learn the
Yes.
tactile?
Yeah. So when we have not done a haptics training in Nebraska yet, to be clear, but we will. We have haptics trainers come in, and the first day they train all the providers, and then the second day the deafblind folks come in, they receive the training, and then kind of copious amounts of practice that happen on day two.
Okay.
Any other questions from the board? Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you
so much for your time and your attention. I am available. You can always email me if you have follow-up questions or give me a call. I am deeply passionate about this work and happy to talk to anybody endlessly about it. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
I'll find you before I leave.
Okay.
I just lost my hearing.
Okay, the next thing we have on the agenda, again, thank you very much for talking with us about that, is the public comment period. So do we have any questions from the public, comments or concerns?
This is Nancy Plural. I have a couple of questions. I mean, a couple of comments, I guess. most of my career, I had an opportunity to work with individuals that were deafblind. And so Bob Deaton, the former deputy director, Cheryl Poff, who was our deafblind kind of coordinator, myself, we worked for years. I mean, many years. We worked with different organizations. We'd get to a point and the other organization would throw up roadblocks and everything. And so when I, just prior to retiring, we got to a point where we had identified VanCro, but we had done research, you know, around the country. So this is, I don't think you know how important this program is. And I guess one of the things to be able to support it is that obviously none of us know all the individuals that are deafblind out there. But all of you are serving across Nebraska. So as you're talking to your local chapters or offices on aging or whatever, you know, being able for us to get names and telephone numbers so VanCro can get applications that are on a waiting list will make a big difference when it comes to numbers when we go to the legislature. The other comment I want to make is that I think that the Commission for the Blind and Visually Impaired has had many names through the years since I've been a part of it, but Dr. Nyman was a real visionary, and since then, every director since then has continued to be a visionary in making sure that individuals with vision loss or whatever secondary disability they might have resources and have the life that they really want for themselves. So Dr. Nyman actually approved a two-week training back in the 80s where Helen Keller and all these deafblind resources came from across the country. And from that, we used to have a program called Hand in Hand that met quarterly for deafblind individuals so they wouldn't be isolated. It's the social isolation that really, the loneliness that people start really totally withdrawing. But also there's increased documentation about dementia. Audiologists and ENTs and that will share that. So this could have a significant impact on people's lives. And then the other thing is just I want to say I had a chance to be a part of the summit, Silver Summit, to attend the NCBBI 50th anniversary for the Orientation Center. And working with the volunteering with the SSP program, and I continue to be in awe of all the hard work that each and every one of you, every staff person and commissioner, everything that you do to improve the lives of individuals across the state.
Nancy, clear. Verizon, status bar item. Damn. Swipe down with three fingers to reveal notifications. Swipe up with three fingers to reveal the control.
Thank you, Nancy. Any other questions, comments, concerns from the public? Okay. Next item on the agenda is a break. We usually do about 15 minutes for that. It is currently 10:02, so we will meet up at, yep, we are a little early. So we'll meet up at 10:17.